What happens when you try to measure something as intimate and messy as human sexuality in a laboratory? You end up with some of the strangest, most uncomfortable, and surprisingly hilarious moments in scientific history. Sex research occupies this peculiar space where rigorous methodology meets profound human vulnerability. For decades, scientists have wrestled with an impossible challenge. How do you study something that fundamentally changes when you're watching it? How do you separate the physical mechanics from the psychological experience when they're so deeply intertwined? This journey through sex research reveals not just what happens in our bodies during intimate moments, but also what happens to science itself when it ventures into society's most protected territory. Before the 1970s, studying sexual physiology meant career suicide. Researchers faced expulsion, FBI watch lists, and death threats. William Masters and Virginia Johnson revolutionized the field by measuring heart rate, blood pressure, and muscle contractions during sex, physiological data that couldn't be faked, unlike self-reported surveys. Their 1966 book, Human Sexual Response, initially generated so much hate mail, they needed extra secretaries. Despite clinical language calling couples reacting units and orgasms orgasmic phase expression, it became a bestseller, answering questions people had asked privately for generations. Their observations revealed misunderstood truths. Outer labia thin during arousal to facilitate penetration, while inner labia enlarge dramatically and change color, a built-in arousal indicator. The clitoris retracts under its foreskin just before orgasm, becoming too sensitive for direct touch. For men, they identified post-ejaculatory gland sensitivity, explaining why continued thrusting after ejaculation feels uncomfortable. These pioneers combined scientific discovery with compassion, not merely collecting data, but helping people understand their bodies and improve relationships. Masters and Johnson's most extraordinary research tool was an artificial coition machine, a mechanical penis with a camera that filmed female sexual response from inside. This device documented hundreds of sexual cycles and revealed that vaginal lubrication comes from plasma seeping through capillary walls, not glandular secretions. Surprisingly, women achieved orgasm from this plastic device's straight-on thrusting, despite 70% of women typically needing clitoral stimulation. The catch? Subjects were pre-screened to be easily orgasmic, hardly representative of average women. Today's research employs even more invasive technology. In Dr. Deng's Taiwan exam room, couples attempt intercourse while ultrasound wands capture internal images. One subject described her partner maintaining an idle, disaffected rhythm while casually chatting with the doctor, then seamlessly transitioning to, "You can ejaculate now." A 2003 team investigated the human penis as a semen displacement device, theorizing that the ridged glands evolved to scoop out competitor semen. Using artificial vaginas and phallus models, they demonstrated ridged penises displaced 91% of competitor semen versus 35% for unridged controls. Laboratory sex barely resembles actual intimacy. Sex transcends its mechanical components. Yet when those parts malfunction, understanding the mechanics suddenly matters tremendously. Princess Marie Bonaparte's 1920s research revealed that women with clitorises more than an inch from their vaginas rarely achieved orgasm during intercourse. Kim Wallen later confirmed this with his rule of thumb. If the clitoris to urethra distance is less than a thumb width, orgasm during intercourse becomes far more likely. Bonaparte underwent two failed surgeries to relocate her clitoris, reflecting the intense pressure women felt about normal sexual response. The 1950s backlash against Kinsey made vaginal orgasm the hallmark of well-adjusted femininity. Marriage manuals eliminated clitoral references. Some physicians even recommended stretching hymens with well-lubricated Pyrex centrifuge tubes. Meanwhile, Ernst Grafenberg identified what became the G-spot on the front vaginal wall, though debate continues whether it's distinct or part of the larger clitoral complex. Kinsey offered the most sensible perspective. Engagement matters most. Women who regularly orgasm during intercourse typically control their own movements rather than depending on their partner's thrusting. As Wallen's research confirms, it's the women's own movement that matters most. The medicalization of impotence shifted dramatically around 1980, culminating with Viagra's 1998 launch. Pfizer brilliantly rebranded impotence as erectile dysfunction, transforming shameful personal failure into a treatable plumbing problem. Though psychological factors remain significant, urologists now typically start with medications, even for likely psychological cases, using them as a bridge while recommending therapy. Medieval approaches blamed witchcraft and demons, with the 1491 Malleus Maleficarum describing witches who could make penises disappear or collect them in birds' nests. By the late 1700s, blame shifted to masturbation, with Samuel Tissot's treatise claiming self-pleasure depleted vital energy and caused impotence, blindness, and insanity. This spawned bizarre anti-masturbation devices, including the penile pricking ring, a metal band with spikes that dug into flesh during nocturnal erections. More elaborate versions included alarms, electric shocks, and painful hair-pulling mechanisms. Parents tied children's hands to headboards, while some physicians applied red-hot wires to children's genitals. 16th and 17th century France saw impotence trials, where accused men faced humiliating public examinations before teams of physicians. When marriage became a sacrament, impotence became grounds for divorce. We've moved from blaming demons to understanding vascular mechanics. Yet despite this progress, many men still feel profound shame, suggesting our cultural attitudes haven't fully caught up with our medical understanding. Mark Elise Sipsky's research shows 40 to 50% of people with spinal cord injuries still experience orgasm, despite injuries that should prevent sexual sensation. Her hotel-like laboratory tracks physiological responses while maintaining subject privacy. Sipsky found only complete injury to sacral nerve roots definitively prevents orgasm, suggesting orgasm functions primarily as an autonomic nervous system reflex, the system controlling involuntary functions like heartbeat and digestion. While spinal injuries block the somatic nervous system, skin sensations, and voluntary movement, the autonomic system often remains functional through alternative pathways. Subjects rarely feel orgasm exclusively in the genitals, reporting sensations all over or from waist down. Some develop compensatory erogenous zones above their injury level where vibration triggers orgasmic responses. People can experience orgasms through thought alone, during epileptic seizures, or spontaneously, all triggering the same reflex with impulses traveling down from the brain rather than up from the genitals. This bidirectional nature suggests the mind might be the true sexual organ, with the body simply providing one pathway to pleasure. Masters and Johnson's 1979 study, Homosexuality in Perspective, found that while physiological arousal was identical across orientations, committed same-sex couples reported the most satisfying experiences. These couples took their time, lingering at each arousal stage and using teasing to prolong excitement. Lesbians derived equal pleasure from giving and receiving, while gay men attended to their partners' entire bodies rather than focusing solely on genitals. Heterosexual couples showed a more goal-oriented approach. Men often missed arousal cues, and women rarely used teasing. While Masters and Johnson noted gender empathy played a role, communication mattered more. Gay couples spoke more openly about preferences. After decades studying thousands of encounters, the researchers concluded the best sex wasn't about technique. It was about losing oneself in mutual pleasure and communication. Science can illuminate pleasure's pathways, but it can't manufacture what makes sex meaningful, the willingness to be fully present, communicate openly, and find joy in mutual exploration rather than performance.